getting to know some people who have done that, and I'm going to talk tomorrow a little bit about individuals who have changed inside and become new human beings. So if you want to come back and listen to me, I don't know what it is. That's after Vespers tomorrow night, so those of you who could stay up, I think it is. And if it is, you have to stay up a little later if you want to hear about it. But to me, also, the essential in ministry to offenders, to prisoners or ex-prisoners, is to become their friend. And that's the continuity of relationship. And it's interesting, in a program that I mentioned, M2 in California, that and that's a program where there's one-on-one relationship with offenders, as people commit themselves to be in that one-on-one relationship. But the legislature did a study, because that program is not a Christian program, although 97% of people are Christians in it, but they spent some money evaluating the program. And it was interesting that they looked at people who qualified for a one-on-one relationship but had no one visit them. And then they looked at them after 6 months, after 12 months, and after 18 months, after they're out. Those who were successful, I'll put this line across here like that. Those who were successful, who had somebody who had qualified for a visitor, didn't have any, had a success rating of about here. Those who had 1 to 3 visits had a success rating about to here. Those who had 3 to 11, the success was up here. Those who had 12 or more, it was up like this. And that's about a 60% success up there. Now that was in 6 months. In 12 months, everything was down some, but it was interesting. Those who nobody came to visit were down about here. Those who had 1 to 3 visits was even less. Those who were up here with the 4 to 11 and 12 or more, or about like that. And in 18 months, it was interesting. This factor was even lower. Now, the fascinating thing about it is that the reason why the relationship broke off someplace after the first, second, or third was the volunteer quit it, didn't like it. That was the biggest reason. Most all the cases, that was the case. And so when you look at that, it shows that an additional rejection had an impact not only on the individual at the time, but its results afterwards in the ability to stay out of prison, stay out of trouble later on. And so that's the significance of the continuity of relationship. If you come to visit a person in prison, you get this done. You can hear. That they're amazed at a person who for no reason at all comes to visit them. And if you come back the second time, it's not double, it's about 4 times once. It's geometrical, the impact it has on 5 people, whatever, want to have anything to do with them. So that's, and then to share Christ is, they need to know from whence the Holy Spirit comes, where they change. But you need to be a friend first before you share Christ. And then the people who will walk with an individual when they come out, I mean, that has the biggest impact if that relationship keeps going. And the last point I wanted to make, I think it's essential that church people be involved in that. There's a lot of programs that are outside of the church, but I think we have a special responsibility as church people. And so that was just kind of a bit of a rehash of that. Now, I said I want to talk about victims and restorative justice. Let me start with victims first. After I became area director of prison fellowship in Minnesota, North Dakota, I would go and make church presentations and just talk about this and try and encourage people to volunteer. And what I found was that there were people who refused to come and listen to me or else sat there seething while I was talking, because I was helping offenders, and what about victims and the people who were victims of crime. And I am appreciative of this one individual who came and explained that to me. And I became more sensitive and aware of that. Offenders are usually elsewhere but in church. And victims are large numbers of church. And they're sitting in church and nobody's doing much to help them. Dan Van Nessen wrote a book, Crime and His Victims, and it'd be something that'd be interesting for all of you to read, Crime and His Victim by Dan Van Nessen. And he pointed out there about how his attitude changed when his home was burglarized, and how, and he used the example that if your home is burglarized and you go to church and you tell your close friend that somebody broke into my home, likely the first thing that person would say, well, didn't you lock your door? And you say, well, it didn't come through the door, it came to the window. Well, don't you keep your windows latched all the time? And your friend, by asking you the question, makes you feel guilty. And then you don't say anything anymore and you suffer alone. We in the church don't know any more about how to reach out to victims than we do to offenders. I talked to a number of pastors who said they just never even thought of it that way. They said they had counseled people who had severe psychological problems, but they never thought of how the church ought to address themselves to the person who was victimized. And the other thing I point out on victims, when I was in Congress, what I would make it a point to do with the people who worked for me, and was when they're in on their talking about their work, I'd ask them about their life, and after a while you'd get into their spiritual life and find out about and inquire how things were going with them. And I was amazed at the high number of women who had been raped or somebody who had attempted to rape them. And I figured if that was a cross-section, that is much greater than we ever see on the incidents of rape that does occur. And the number who never had told anybody else about that, and they'd just been suffering through that at that time. And you know, our criminal justice system in the past has treated people who were raped, you know, like Potiphar's wife, and wondering to what extent they were at fault, and that sort of thing too. So there is an enormous suffering that's going on, and difficulty of handling it. There was one experience, though, of a victim that really amazed me. And I got a call one day, just this last year, from a woman who told me about what had happened to her daughter in Chicago. Her daughter was a civil rights attorney in Chicago and was on her way to work. And a mugger grabbed her purse, and she was a strapped purse, and she hung on to it, and the guy swung her around. She did a little more than 360 degrees before the strap broke, and she then was thrown over and hit her head and was killed. And later on, this man was apprehended mugging another person, and he still had the purse with him so they could trace him to that. He had mugged another person a little earlier than that, got $7.50 from her, and this woman was the second one, and they picked them up, I guess, on the third one. And he did not know that he had killed the attorney. And her mother called me up and said that she wanted to get a hold of the authorities in Chicago. She had been attempting to and wasn't able to do it. They didn't want to talk to her. And because she wanted to tell them that she forgave this man because he had not intended to kill her daughter. And she felt that it would probably help with his rehabilitation if he knew that she forgave him for that. You know, what an amazing woman who would do that. And so I called Prison Fellowship's area director in Chicago, Bill Watts, and told him about the situation and asked if he knew the people in criminal justice sufficiently that they could connect her with the offender. And he did, and had read about the case and knew about that and hooked them up. And the man who had committed the crime, who was a black man, comment was he didn't know that there were white people who would treat him in that way. And that's what we're talking about on reconciliation, restorative justice, a possibility. And there are unique times when such a thing starts out early, and sometimes it takes a long time when that occurs. What I'd like to do is stop right now, and since we're talking about justice, and just see if I could gather from you, if you wanted to tell me what your definition of justice is. I mean, how would you explain justice? Just in the vernacular, how do you explain what it was? If anybody wanted to do that to me, I mean, I'm not going to give you a test or anything like that.
Equality of punishment.
Equality of punishment.
Yes.
Okay. That's one. Anybody else? Yes.
Let whoever is affected in a given situation be treated fairly. Then you have to define fairly.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That person be treated fairly. Anybody else?
I think justice is in the eyes of the individual beholder. It differs from person to person.
Okay. Anybody else?
I'm thinking of the symbol. You have a blindfolded person holding the scales of justice.
Mm-hmm.
That's what came to me.
Mm-hmm. That would be equality, right? When I was governor, every candidate for judgeship that I interviewed, I had a system where the Bar Association and the Association of Judges picked certain people who would review candidates, and I had appointed some people who would do it even number. And then they'd recommend three people to me, and I would interview them. And I asked every one of them, would you define for me the difference between love and justice? And it was fascinating to me of the definitions that people who had spent the time in the legal profession, and some of them were judges in lower court, I was appointing them to a higher court, in their view on that. Frankly, I didn't point anybody who wasn't able to explain the difference to me, because I think it's important. I think institutions need to operate out of justice, but love operates from individuals, and that's why you need a system of laws. But deviation from that can occur from the judge as he expresses his love for people. That would be my view. But one of the things I noticed in justice is that there are some people who think of justice as the punishment for the guilty. The guilty getting their just rewards. And there are other people who think of justice all the time as the poor or the oppressed getting more of a fair share of the economy. And it is interesting that people who tend to be more vertical in their relationship with God tend to think on punishment a little bit more than those who are more horizontal, who are looking at social programs. All the time, they tend to be thinking of people, the poor, getting their just desserts, what's available out there. I just thought I'd toss that out of what I noticed with it. And so often, justice is defined as, and Niebuhr does this, as you get what's coming to you. That's what justice is. But it's a lot more complicated and broader than that. And it also is something that we need to have a particular look at as people who are followers of Christ. And love, you forgive 70 times 7. Love fits within that, because I want to put it just as concise as possible. Now, it's interesting looking at some examples of Christ's relationship with both offenders and victims. And as I mentioned last night, the one story that everybody remembers on dealing with victims is the Samaritan who found that person who had been robbed and beat and injured on the road, and the priest and the Levite had gone on the other side. And Christ used that to explain to the legalist that who his neighbor was. The guy was trying to put Christ on the spot, you know, who's my neighbor? And he told that story. And so he had a lot of meaning to it. As I look at it, Christ never laid down hard and firm rules like you'd read in Deuteronomy. I mean, looking what's in the heart. And so we look at the rules that people learn out of, that you can read about in Deuteronomy, but then saying, you know, if you lust after a woman that's committing adultery, so it's what is in your heart, or if you hate your brother, it's murder, so you aren't any better by doing that. So you have to look at this as not hard and fast rules on how one operates, because, as I mentioned last night, as far as the victim was concerned in the Samaritan story, the priest and the Levite walked on the other side because under their custom and law, if they'd helped him, they'd have been stuck with him. It would have been their responsibility from then on. And the Samaritan could pay his way and go back home and send some more money if they needed it. And so they never talked about as an example of a priest or a Levite or somebody who would be stuck with him if he had them right there. So that's one of the factors that we have. The other part is the offender, that the one who repented and said that they're getting their just reward because they were criminals that had committed crimes and Christ didn't. Christ said to him when he asked Christ to remember him that he would be with Christ in paradise. And so it's interesting that an offender or a criminal is the only person in the Bible that Christ promised that there would be a paradise. So you need to have exact proof. There's only one person who there is exact proof. So you know when you go to heaven, you're going to have some criminals with you, if that's an indication there. The other person that's interesting is the prostitute who, in looking up the law, and the Jewish law was the offender, but because of the circumstances was the victim. And so people can be both offenders and victims. And I wondered to what extent that the men who were standing around her had also involved in the act when with the prostitute. And there again, Christ saying that he was without sin, cast the first stone. And the only admonition to her was to go and sin no more. And so we see in that relationship that love and healing that was dominant, really, of shalom. When you look at each of those cases, the Samaritan, It brought healing and peace. When you look at the one person that hang on the cross, there was healing and peace with him. And with the prostitute, there was healing and peace as well. But in our criminal justice system, it doesn't work that way. We have a different system. Here, the purpose of our criminal law really is to punish. And by rights, people who are involved in the criminal justice system should be healers, binding up wounds and being healers. And Dan Van Ness writes about a judge who the victim was in the courtroom when he pronounced judgment. And he could see by looking at her about how unsettled she was. And so he called her up to the bench when he had read his sentence and said to her, "I hope you know that what I have done demonstrates conclusively that what happened was not your fault." And she began to weep, and the tears were flowing down her cheeks. And a few days later, he called the family to see how she was, and they told him that the psychological healing had begun with that time. So she was vindicated. It was not her fault. And so when we now talking about restorative justice, we're talking about the healing that can occur. Now, one of our difficulties is that we have lived so long under our present system that our thinking just doesn't come through to understand restorative justice, the kind of justice that would be biblical justice. And you really need to have a different thinking, virtually the same as it did when people believed that the earth was flat and everything else was going around us. And when they finally realized the earth was round, the one thing that changed is you knew that the earth wasn't stationary. There was truth to the belief of when the earth was flat, the sun and the moon and the stars were moving. I mean, they are moving, but it wasn't true that we were standing still and we're flat, that we were also a globe and moving as well, and that was the difference. And it was tough for people to make that kind of a paradigm shift in their thinking, the lens through which they saw it. And so we need to have that kind of a change. The way it is now in our current system is first you go and establish that the offender was guilty, and you assign a punishment to the offender. And that demonstrates that law-breaking is socially unacceptable. And it also is looked at as to defer offenders or others from doing the same kind of criminal activity. And it also incapacitates them, so it restricts their ability, even if they wanted to exercise that kind of criminal activity, by taking their personal freedom away from them. That's the way it operates now. But prisons have little effect on the crime rate, or perhaps even increase the crime rate, because it's identified as a college course in crime. And so instead of rehabilitating the offenders, it makes them worse. And recidivism is repeat offenders, is far greater among people who go to prison. And so if you take two identical offenders, and one who goes on probation and the other one goes to prison, the recidivism rate of those who went on probation is far less than those who go to prison. And so what do? We send people to longer terms in prison as a result of what we're about. And it costs more and more money, but even that failure hasn't caused us to quit doing that. Can you do that? Can you get a picture, though, of how long your sentences are going to affect the commission of crimes? About a third of the crimes are reported, and about 20% of the reported crimes, there is an arrest. And about half of the rest, there's a conviction. And about half of those go to prison. So when you look at the number of crimes that are committed, about 1.5% of those crimes are somebody goes to prison. So you can imagine that, I mean, the odds are pretty great that you aren't going to get caught when there's only 1.5%, and so doubling their sentence isn't going to affect that very much. The ancient system of justice, however, is the one that we have gone away from. Now, there are two things that happen that caused us to have our current system of justice. The one happened at the time of William the Conqueror, and because of the Norman invasion, the king needed a lot of money, and so he then centralized the whole process and put political authority himself, that the church and the community has been handling the questions of dispute resolution up until that time. And then his son, Henry I, put this, codified that, and made it so it was an offense against the king's peace if you committed arson or robbery or murder or false coinage or crimes of violence. And so that was the beginning of that change. And so, therefore, the state could get more money and to wage their wars. And the king became the victim rather than the individual who had been wrong. And by that, restitution went by the wayside. And instead, they used whipping and stocks and punishment of that nature in order to punish the crime. And when one looks at that, justice became future-oriented, in that you create the punishment in order to prevent people from doing things in the future, while the restitution and the former system of justice, it was to restore people, and is past-oriented and was victim-centered, and now the victim became, the individual who was hurt became ignored. And when one looks at that system, you look at the history of Babylonian law, and you look at Roman law, and you look at pre-colonial African law, and you look at the system of justice written of in the Bible. And each one of those, they were victim-oriented, and if there was a crime committed, and then you had to make restitution to the victim. And it was the Hebrew community that developed that whole concept of shalom, of peace. When you committed a crime, you broke the relationship between people, you broke the peace, you not only affected that individual, you affected the community as well. And so I found it fascinating one time when a Hebrew scholar, a rabbi, spoke to a group of congressmen. And we asked him this whole question about, wasn't the old Jewish law harsh because it was an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth and a life for a life? And he said, we tend not to understand it from what the advances that have occurred with Jewish law. Because prior to that, if you were of a lower class, you were treated differently. If a nobleman should take the eye of a servant, and then there would not be any punishment for it, but if he took the eye of another nobleman, and then there would be punishment. But in the Jewish law, no matter what your standing or class in society, and then it was still an eye for an eye or tooth for a tooth. So that was an advancement in justice rather than a harsh system of justice. And the second change that occurred was 200 years ago this year. And that was in Philadelphia. The Quakers decided that that whole system of whippings and stocks and branding and pain that was being used was inhuman. And therefore, they developed a new system. And that was, they would have individual cells, so people get away from immoral elements of society that they've been traveling with. And they gave them a Bible, which they could read, and they sentenced them a certain time so they would have time to contemplate. And there they would become penitent and change. And that's why we call these things penitentiaries. And so that didn't deter them. We have continued on that whole program after that. And even though it is a great expenditure, the first thing went to hard work and try to penalize people with hard work. And then there was discipline and training. And now we have the medical and psychological treatment that we're attempting to do at all times. It has failed. And I think it's failed primarily because there's an overly optimistic view of human nature, of man's goodness. And I think Malcolm Muggeridge kind of sets it in the best way, saying a quick statement that fits with original sin when Malcolm Muggeridge says, human beings are no damn good. And if you start from that, only the goodness comes from God. And so those are the things that had happened, and why we moved away from restorative justice to the retribution that should be brought against the people who was left the victim out. And now there's a movement that's going on to bring back restorative justice again. And that's what I wanted to give you a little bit of feeling for. And that instead of crime being simply law-breaking, crime is really injury. And if there's injury, then there ought to be brought about healing. And so I'm going to give you a couple of diagrams that I wrote down here, and kind of get that picture for you up on the board, the current one now. So if you look at it the way it is now, here's government up here, and offender, and we better put another F on that one in there, and up here, put a kind of a dotted line like that, order, and up here, fairness. And so, when a person has committed a crime, and then right now it's a relationship between the offender and government, the victim is pretty well left out of it. And sometimes they're called in to be a witness, and sometimes they're totally ignored. And the reason is that the government wants to maintain order and security, and that is the responsibility of government to maintain order. And the due process has been developed for the years to bring about fairness. But there are two groups that are left out. So I'll put government over here and the offender down here. And the victim is left out presently, and the community. Under the old system, it was the community that had the primary responsibility, and now under the present system, it's the government that has the primary responsibility. And now if we look at it in that way, it's the two other parties that are involved in it. And the reason why I draw a circle now instead of a direct each one of them. And when one looks at then what is going to occur between them, we'll just put in here those same dotted lines like we got in the past, and we'll put one up here like that to kind of get the picture of it. And again, the government's responsibility is for order, and I'll put it across here so you can read my bad handwriting better if it's flat and if it's sideways. You really couldn't read it then at all. And then as I spoke of the relationship of the judge with the victim, it's vindication, vindicate the victim, and with the community is to bring peace. Now when you look at the difference between them, of order and peace, that when you think of peace, there's reconciliation and there's cooperation. But when there's order, it's power, and to bring about security. And there's a harshness about that that has to be brought about. You have the fairness in which you deal with the offender, and the vindication to the victim. And what that brings about is then you have the community both healing the victim, and then works on rehabilitation of the offender. And the government is attempting to redress the harm that occurred to the victim, and also bring to try and enable the offender to make up for the injury that he was done, that he did. Because right now, as you punish the offender, in that case, the offender is passive and the government is the active part of it. But if you go to restitution, and then the offender becomes the one who's active and is participating in overcoming the injury. And so we use the word recompense instead of retribution, which are similar from each other. And so when you think of a crime being having been committed, it's not only the direct victim that has been affected, it has been the community as well. And that's why in some areas where there's a high crime rate, you know, there's enormous work that needs to be done in order to bring about peace. And when we talk to the black churches in Los Angeles to get started in our programs out there, they just found it impossible to be working with the offender. But to be able to work with victims or families, that's where they could get started with them and started building some sense of peace. But eventually, one would have to go to the offender. Now, we have a separate part of Prison Fellowship Ministries called Justice Fellowship that works on this area to try and develop restorative justice, which takes which requires legislative change. And there are 14 states now where we're working, and we're going to expand hopefully to about 40 states, to where task forces are developed, people who are interested in developing understanding, and then to pass legislation to bring about restorative justice, which will enhance what's already been starting, laws to bring restitution to victims, and to give victims standing in court, so that in criminal cases, the victims will have a standing in court, and would even have a voice in the sentencing. And you can't just leave it entirely to the victim, because some of the feeling of revenge and so forth, they may not have the fairness of. The government has to play a role in it. All four of them need to play a role in it. We also are working on two victim programs. One of them is to develop a system where we train churches how to work with victims when it does occur, and also to provide some assistance. For instance, if there's a burglary and it happened on a weekend, and the person wasn't able to get a locksmith till Monday, they would have the feeling of exposure if there's no way they can lock their door until Monday came about. But there are carpenters or people who can do that in church, and if the church would let the church know, somebody would go there and fix the lock on the door. If it's a single woman and she feels violated and threatened now that her home has been entered into, and the fear of sleeping there alone at night, a member of the church would go and stay with her until she felt more secure in the future, and also be able to start addressing the psychological and spiritual needs that occur at the time when they've been violated by the crime. We have three places where we started out piloting that and then hope to expand. One is in Montgomery, Alabama. Second one is Arlington, Virginia. And the third in Washington, D.C. is working very well in Montgomery, Alabama. The police are very cooperative, and as soon as there is a crime committed, they notify the churches who are involved of the victim, and they can immediately move into action.
Well, the victim doesn't have a church.
But that doesn't make a difference. The church will come and help them out. It isn't their church. Where was the victim?
Oh,
they'll just
I
call
see.
The church and say, who'll come in? And give them a hand.
So there are individual churches
who are part of this
doing
program.
This program,
yeah.
Not necessarily the church I would be involved
no,
in.
No, that's right. It'd be individual churches doing that. And that's their ministry to their community, to do that. Mm-hmm. And in Arlington, we're having difficulty because the police won't cooperate in giving the victims or calling the churches and let them know the victims. They will give the victim a card which indicates the name of the church that he's on. See, but that isn't the personal contact. You know, when you're in that state, you're as likely to call up a stranger, and so you get difficulty there. And we're just working on D.C., but it seems like the police are going to be cooperative there, and so we'll be able to operate a program. So that, I tell you, it's just getting started, and we're learning how to work that. And then the other one is the VORP program, Victim Offender Rehabilitation Program. Try and bring about that there will not really be peace in the community until there is a reconciliation. And that's when the true peace has occurred. And I witnessed that in I was out here in Seattle. And met with a group of people, and where a woman and the man and her husband and the man who had murdered her brother were together, and that reconciliation had occurred between them. And I tell you, that had powerful impact on all the people when you saw that had occurred. And in Minnesota, when I was area director, I was involved with an attempt at reconciliation. And I don't know if it's subsequent was done, but we got so far but didn't complete it because the person who had been stabbed, a woman who, she and her husband had a mini storage place, and a guy came in there one day and wanted to look at the mini storage, and came back the next day when there wasn't anybody around, and again went and looked at the mini storage and came back, and she was alone, and stabbed her a number of times, and she lived through it and all. And then she and her husband came to me because the guy, when he came out, would be in the same community as they were. You know, that's a horrible thing to go to the supermarket and go down the aisle, run across the person who had stabbed you. And I imagine the person too, if there was change in his life, to run across if there had no work in reconciliation. And so at first both parties were willing to begin that reconciliation, meet face to face. And then she decided that she didn't want to go through with it at that time. And I don't believe anything like that ought to be forced, but just the time you work on it until you bring it about. And then the same thing with myself. The first time I went into prison as an area director in our maximum security prison, the person wanted to see me, who I'd been avoiding every time I go to a state institution when I was governor, because we'd had the same circumstance, and the member of the Cui family. And so he wanted to meet with me. And we sat there alone in the chaplain's office. And you know, my first reaction is I couldn't turn him down, because I was new area director. If I refused to meet with him, you know, what kind of standing would I have amongst all the inmates around the state? And he asked me, he said when he saw me on television, he thought of the crime that he had committed. And he felt that if ever could see me, he'd want to ask for forgiveness. And so he said, it was longer than that, but he asked me for forgiveness. I told him that I thought it behooved anybody of whom forgiveness was requested to respond to them. And I told him that I did forgive him. And I know that was the Spirit of God in me, because I had had all kinds of different feelings about him before that. And he broke down and cried for about 3 minutes, and then asked if he'd give me a hug. I told him I was waiting for him to get composure enough to do that. And that from then we went out to the Bible study, and I realized how important that was. Because as we sat side by side in the Bible study, we were like brothers. If I had seen him across the table in that Bible study without that, it would have, I would have been beside myself looking at him and wondering about him at all. And so I witnessed myself what reconciliation can do. But that's really what we're talking about in restorative justice. It's really changing the whole way that our criminal justice system operates. And it's a different system in which the church will operate in the future. And it really is a different system of responsibility and community than we have now. The attempt now is, take in Washington, D.C. The prison system is outside of Washington, D.C. in Larkin Penitentiary. And it's difficult for people in the center city to go and visit anybody they know in the prison, if they're members of family, because people in the center city use public transportation. And so I noticed our volunteers for Larkin Penitentiary tended to be only people from out in the suburbs. There'd be the white middle class out in the suburbs, the black weren't able to get out there. Now they're going to build some new prisons because the crime is expanding so much there. And they're going to put those new prisons, they expect, over in West Virginia. Now it could be absolutely impossible for those families to get out there. And so the healing won't occur in community. I think that one needs to look even in center cities in the way of community to where churches take responsibility. The way those 8 pastors in Los Angeles now have said, we're going to take responsibility. This is going to be our program, and we're going to start moving in this direction. So that's what I know about it, and I'll respond to questions.
Now, well, I just like to relate an experience that I have. I'm a member of the Optimist International, and in the Los Angeles area, we operate a boys' home and now a girls' home for offenders who are of high school age, basically up to 21. and we can accommodate 85 boys in this one residential setting. We have no locks on the doors. There's no bars. These boys can come and go if they, you know, if they can handle it. But they're wards of the court, and they have a choice. If they go out and leave our establishment, they immediately go to a prison. So we have a success rate now that's up in the 80% of the people that we are able to accommodate. And it's totally a rehabilitation, a healing kind of situation, an educational background. They get a high school diploma if they are, you know, complete the courses and do what they should in that regard. So it's strictly a healing, rehabilitating kind of thing with no locks. Mm-hmm. In a sense. Mm-hmm. And it's not a punishment, it's a healing. Mm-hmm. And it's successful. Mm-hmm. And it's been operating now since 1906. Mm-hmm. And it's up to the point now where we're just building a new building, hoping to be able to take more. And we have started in the last two or three years now of making it available to girls as well, and we have about 20 now girls and about 85 boys.
Mm-hmm. What's the racial mix? Do you have any idea?
I really don't know how to answer that. We have a lot of colored. There's a lot of blacks, but many Chicanos, and a lot of whites, Anglos. So, it's pretty well split.
Tell them where it is.
Well, it's in Los Angeles, the Eagle Rock. If you go to Los Angeles, Figueroa Street.
Near Pasadena.
It's between, close to Pasadena. It's very successful.
Good.
I just think it's a wonderful program.
Good.
My question had to do with, certainly within the Christian context, the issue or the idea of restorative justice makes good sense to me personally, and I would think to Christians in general. What about non-Christians in the whole criminal justice system? Does that, from a humanitarian perspective, are they equally as sympathetic?
The VORC program got developed not out of churches, and we want the churches to be involved in the VORC program. They're running into difficulty in getting adequate funding for it, but that's where that originated. And the whole concept of restitution that is now moving in the laws that the offender makes restitution to those. There's a lot of effort from non-Christian groups as well, and that, and probably the leadership that got started was from non-Christian groups. So we're not alone in that. A lot of times we're Johnny Come Latelys. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know that.
And the second part of that is, in light of everything you've been saying tonight, you're wanting as a society bigger and more prisons. And where are we going to turn the corner there?
Well, somewhere or other we need to bring this understanding of restorative justice, because I don't see any change from the trend that is going towards more and more prisons and longer sentences and more severe all the time. And then with the increase in sentencing, and the longer sentences is the longer time before, if there was restitution, that the person could pay back to the victim anything towards the harm that he or she had created. And so there is a struggle between those who advocate restitution and those who want longer sentences, all the push for longer sentences, really go contrary to the need that will move towards restoring individuals. And so I don't see that turned around. It seems to me that politicians more and more feel that in order to be successful in their campaign, they have to be tough on crime. And so there are more and more people advocating capital punishment, more and more people advocating long sentences and determinate sentencing.
Well, we have a prison system that they let the prisoners into an area near where we live, you see. And
where's that?
In Hastings, Nebraska.
Okay.
And they're supposed to be, well, the people will be out of prisons in about maybe a year or so, just finishing up there. Mm-hmm. And we're finding that some of them will escape or do something, so they're not released. They mm-hmm. won't stay.
A lot of times in the last week, it occurred. Because they're so frightened of what's on the outside. They live so much of their life on the inside.
So evidently rehabilitation hasn't been for them or something.
No, it hasn't
been. They're afraid to get out into the society.
It hasn't been. I don't think that we ought to give up on rehabilitation. I think it's a part of it, but to depend on rehabilitation, prisons just never rehabilitated anybody. And, I got to be a friend of a guy who I thought he was the biggest con artist in Stillwater Prison in Minnesota, and got to know him when I started visiting in there. And when he got over what you say the minimum security part, they call it the farm there, and he was so scared, but when he was coming out, and he had good reason to be too, because he had the toughest time getting a job when he came out. And I contacted the legislature and told them that they shouldn't be fearful of him being a con artist because the place was full of it anyway. And therefore, he did get a little bit of work there. And now he's the editor of a newspaper that he got started, and he's successful out of there. But he'd been in prison a number of times before in his life, but he just came to the resolve this time that he was going to stay out. And he had changed it inside. And so, you do see those success stories like that. But I think it was helpful that he was able to call me up, and he still does, and he'd have a friend who was on the outside. That's why I maintain that their friend, the ones who put themselves back in again, either before they get out or soon after they get out, there's nobody who's their friend other than the ones who are going to get them back in the same trouble again.
But it is also, could it be that they know they've got three meals a day, they've got the entertainment, they've got everything going for them, especially in this minimum security prison that they're in. And some think that maybe they just think that's a better way.
Parasites on society? If, however, that's the basic needs of the human being. And that's what we all want. Three meals a day,
place of shirt, and
clothes. And we usually go to where we're sure of it. And you're sure of it if you volunteer up here in Holden. And you're sure of it if you've got a job someplace, And they just use some illegal ways of doing it, or else they're taking it. Found it works there, and it hasn't worked elsewhere for them. And so, what I want to stress that is to make sure we don't cast aspersion on so that we look at them as hopeless individuals. That's what it is. Yeah, some of them have no skills at all when they get out of there to get a job. Yeah.
Is there a program such that when the offenders come out of prison that there is some relationship with someone within the community itself? Like you said, for this individual, that they can contact you versus a parole officer or anything else so that they know somebody from the outside to come to.
Mm-hmm. We tried that and it doesn't work.
It doesn't work.
Because you need to establish the relationship before they come out.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah. So
is something like that happening so that you know the person in prison and have an ongoing relationship mm-hmm. within them in the prison, and then when they come out, remain in the area so that that is, that continues.
Yeah, we just developed that program in Minnesota, and we were the first ones to start it with Prison Fellowship Ministry while I was there. And we've got 30 people that we have a mentor who walks with them now. And then in this system, we have one person who is a chair for the Twin Cities, and we divided the Twin City metropolitan area into six areas, and then we have one person, each person called a networker. Once a month, they meet together and discuss what they're doing, and they start out with Bible study, prayer, and fellowship, and eat breakfast together. And then they do that, and then each of these networkers do it with their mentor, the person who they secured to mentor, the person who's in prison. And then when the person comes out, then he joins with the group. So it's that small group all the way up through. This is the way we're building it there. And at first, we had to build trust with the prisoners that they'd even try us out. And then secondly, we ran difficulty getting people in the churches to want to do it, because they had somebody who had an interest in it, had to then be able to walk with another person who was doing it to get confidence enough in between to do it. A non-Christian organization, when I say non-Christian, it wasn't based on the churches, though, but the people are Christians who belong there, is Amicus in Minnesota, who helped teach us all they knew about it, which has been going for some time. And that is the same thing. Mostly the friend relationship in prison, they do some walking with people when they come out. And they have about 160 matches going right now using the state of Minnesota. And the success rate?
Well, I mean, how long has it been going on?
Oh, in Amicus? I would guess around 18 years.
And what is the success rate for people coming out?
Excellent. Success rate.
What's that?
Excellent.
Yeah.
Between 8% and 12% recidivism instead of 74% rearrested in 4 years away.
What did you say at the beginning? 8 to 12%
recidivism. Over and against the 74%, the national figures.
Huh.
The number of people, that's the percentage of people who leave prison who are rearrested in 4 years. That doesn't mean they go back into prison necessarily. There's a 74%. There's about 25% success rate, and something close to 90% success rate in the other. You have to bear in mind, that's a different human being who now has accepted another person to befriend them. But you probably weren't here. What I found when I interviewed people who had successfully stayed out for a period of time, male and female, every one of them could point to the person who walked with them when they came out. Every one of them. And the ones who put themselves in again, or like talked about even before they even got out, they had nobody to walk with them other than the old crowd. So that is really a key. And when you talk to superintendents, wardens, chaplains, if you say you'll develop a program and stick with it, of people who will walk with inmates, juvenile or adult, after they get out, their eyes light up, because now they see hope that that can occur. And so I think that's the way we need to be working. But it's frightening for people to do it.